No, I'm not doing anything.
Hello, everybody. So good to see you all. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Lisa Lorraine Smith. I'm the Chief Program Officer here at the network. And today we have our two co-chairs, Amy Newman from JFNCS Atlanta and Yonit Hoffman from CJE Senior Life. And today's going to be a different kind of day in that we have a speaker who's going to talk with us about a special opportunity that can be in all of your communities. And she's going to talk for around 10 minutes, and we're going to give around 5 minutes for questions and answers. And then it's going to be your group to, are you letting everyone in, Yonit?
I can.
I will. There we go. They'll, of course, talk with you about that. So what I am going to do right now is introduce Tamar Simon, who is the founder of Mean Streets Management, which is a film marketing distribution and PR company. And she's going to talk to us about a new film which belongs in this Holocaust survivor community, children of survivors and all organizations and people committed to helping our Jewish elderly communities. So I think you should tell them more about what this movie is and explain what you, how they could potentially bring this to their communities. So take it away, Tamar Simon.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Lisa. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. And Amy, and hello, Yonit also, and everyone. Thanks so much for being here, everybody. I see a couple names that I recognize from kind of the emails I've been doing. So thank you so much, Lisa. Again, my name is Tamar Simon. I run a company called Mean Streets Management, and I partner with the high-profile North American movie distributors when they pick up very high content and high level Jewish films that usually have some A-list stars in them and really intriguing stories. And these are our stories. These are our Jewish stories that Hollywood makes a lot of money off of. And I really believe that these stories belong to us and we should get access to these films early, easily, and also access to the talent involved. So this is a very unique film that I was actually pretty surprised got picked up by such a high profile distributor, but learning more about the film and the people involved and the high caliber of it, it does actually make a lot of sense. So when the distributor reached out to me, it was actually really exciting because I've gotten a chance really to delve into your worlds, which you work in so tirelessly and with so much passion and love into the Holocaust education space, where I've really stayed more in like kind of the Jewish education space, which obviously there's a very strong overlap, but it's really been an honor to be more involved in the Holocaust education space because of this film and its uniqueness, especially because there's no violence in it. And that it's really something that will and is attracting people who might otherwise not want to see a film about the Holocaust or might never even care to know about anything related to the Holocaust. So with that, I wanted to show the trailer first, right, Lisa? We can do that. And then I'll just delve into our presentation, which is mostly just slides with this very long story. So I'll ask you to bear with me and then we'll take some questions at the end. So with that, I have to share screen. Let's see how we do that. Share screen. Okay, let's see if this works. Share sound. I'm gonna, hopefully this is gonna work. So let me, hold on a second. Sorry, forgive me for a second.
You're not sharing your screen yet.
Yeah, I'm just switching.
Okay.
Let's share. Let's see if that works. Share. Oh, that worked. Awesome. Okay. And hopefully this will work. Okay.
It should.
For the Jewish inhabitants of Naszelsk in Poland, nothing remains. The only thing left is an absence. These 3 minutes of life were taken out of the flow of time.
When I discovered my grandfather's film, all I could do was to piece together the few fragments that remained. I had to look at the world around the images to find a survivor.
I recognized myself immediately in that smile.
There were a lot of people, the whole city. It was like a magic moment.
By defining the loss of that world, we might succeed in keeping the memory alive.
We have faces as traces.
The imminence of the danger.
The absence.
The presence.
So you have to unshare. Up top, there's an unshare, a stop share. There you go.
Sorry, you can't hear me. I'm going to go back into a screen share, but just when you go into the screen share, the top right, you can click one of those like little lines, and that'll make it go even smaller so you can see what's on the right side of your screen, because sometimes it cuts off. And I encourage you to watch the trailer again, because I know some of the things were cut off there. Okay, let me try to do this slide. Okay, here we go. And so, yeah, from the top right, if you click like the minus sign, it should hopefully take away all the other faces. Let me move this away. Okay. So thank you so much again, everyone, for having me. And thank you to the Network of Jewish Human Service Agencies for hosting me to talk about this film. So just as a background, so Glenn Kurtz found his grandparents' color home movie from their 1938 vacation to Europe. It's a 14-minute video. He found it in his dad's attic in South Florida, and it was disintegrating. And the 3 minutes of the 14 minutes is from a small town that they visited on this trip, summer of 1938. It's a very busy day, as you saw in the trailer. Lots of people are outside. There are a lot of children. Everyone's trying to get into the video, mugging for David Kurtz, Glenn's grandfather, to like be in this video. So Glenn finds it. He donates the original footage to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. They're able to restore it, and they put it online in their archive. So there's a digital version of it. So Glenn spends like 2 years trying to figure out what's going on in this film and who are these people. And he is able to figure out that the town is Nashelsk. It's this small town, like maybe I think 30 miles from Warsaw. And it's where his grandfather David was actually born. So the film is taken in August 1938. Kristallnacht, as everyone knows, is November 38. And a year later, Germany invades Poland in September 1939. So the Jewish community of Nashelsk was wiped out during the war. They were actually a train depot, so a lot of the trains went through the town. So really, this is the last vestige of proof that many of the people in the film, the Jews, actually existed. Of the 3,000 Jews, only 100 survived. So like I said, Glenn spends 2 years trying to figure out what's going on in this film, who these people are. He really comes up with nothing. And then really a miracle happens. So it's really 2 years later, and there's a family in Detroit, the Chandler family. They're looking for information on in Nashelsk, where their grandfather Maurice, who's 86 at the time, is from. And they want to make actually a family video about their grandfather's last trip to Nashelsk with one of his daughters to show her where he was born. And they stumble onto the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's archive online of these 3 minutes. They watch the film, and suddenly they see really the face of the family. I believe this is actually the face that's Maurice in the little photo above on the corner. And they see him as a 13-year-old boy amongst all these kids crowding David Kurtz. So they tell Maurice, again, he's 86, and then they connect with Glenn. Turns out they're like fourth cousins, because everyone's related, obviously, from the small town. So they show Maurice the film, and it brings back his whole childhood. There's actually a video at also with the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum called It's Grandpa, and it's really, they recorded this whole viewing party with Maurice and his children and Glenn in South Florida watching this with Maurice. So he would really tell people he was from Mars, and suddenly there was proof that he had a childhood. He was the only one to survive from his immediate family. His story of evading the Nazis it's just mind-blowing. So he's able to help Glenn identify more people in the film, connect Glenn to survivors and to family members. Glenn writes a book called 3 Minutes in Poland, which many of you might also be familiar with. And he really starts to build this community of people related to Nashelsk. So now we get to the movie. So Bianca Stigter is a film critic living in Amsterdam. She's looking for a film archive content project for the Rotterdam Film Festival. She has been working with her husband on his films. He's pretty famous. He's Steve McQueen. He's the director of the Oscar-winning 12 Years a Slave, which also won Brad Pitt an Oscar. Bianca finds Glenn's Facebook post randomly one day. It says 3 minutes in Poland. She clicks on it. She learns about the archival footage, contacts Glenn. Fast forward over 5 years, there are a bunch of other smaller projects about the content, but she, together with Steve and the team really in Amsterdam, produced the film that is today 3 minutes a lengthening. So what is the film? The film is really a deep dive into the story of Glenn finding the footage and restoring it with the museum, with this narration from Helena Bonham Carter, which many of you might know from films like Sweeney Todd and the Harry Potter films. But she's also someone just remarkable, is actually Jewish. And there's also, Glenn's also narrating, Maurice is narrating. So there's no violence in this film because it's really just the 3 minutes of footage, which is pre-World War II, and it's this town, and there's really no talking heads. It's a very unique way of learning about the Holocaust and learning about footage as well. And it's really, you watch the 3 minutes, you go backwards, you go forwards, you zoom in, zoom out, color correct, focus on these people with a whole narration. It's really like fascinating to watch it. So the film premieres at the Venice Film Festival, one of the top film festivals in the world. And a distributor called Neon, it's their sister company called Super, they buy North American rights. So that's theatrical rights. It might also be like TV rights, but they buy the rights to show the movie in North America. So just a little bit more about the film. So after Venice, it does what very few films do, which is like the 3 for 3 in the fall in the international film and film market world. It premieres at Telluride and Toronto as well. And then it does Sundance, Amsterdam, Sweden, Dublin. It starts playing Jewish film festivals. It's played in around maybe 30 or 35 by now. Upcoming will be the Sydney Film Festival and the Brussels Film Festival. So it's really the first time that an independent documentary about the Holocaust, maybe even any film about the Holocaust, not made by Jews, not produced or funded by any Jewish organizations, and it's had such a prestigious release internationally in the film festival circuit. And it was also bought for North American theatrical rights. So it'll actually be in theaters across America, also in Canada. So, and like we said before, like because there's no violence in the film, it's really this day in the life with the narration, which does go into a little bit more about what happened to the town. I would just say that also as a disclaimer in terms of, you know, there's a lot of triggering with content with the communities that you work with. So it's something just to be aware of, and I'm happy to share the film so you'll actually be able to see what I'm talking about. But it's attracting people who might otherwise never want to see a film about the Holocaust or never be, again, exposed to or hear about because of just how high profile it is through really the distribution companies. So in terms of what's gonna happen with the theater, it's gonna open in US, it's been playing in, you know, the film festival circuit, like pre-release, the lead up. It's gonna open in 15 cities across, oh, I'm so sorry. There is something going on outside. I'm gonna just move while I talk for a second. The film's gonna open in around 15 cities in commercial theaters starting August 18th in New York and Los Angeles. It's also gonna have a special screening at the Museum of Tolerance before it opens in Los Angeles. Cities that are getting theatrical runs, it means the film's going to play in a commercial theater for around a week with 2 to 5 screenings a day. So Neon.
Tamar, can you get to what the agencies can do? Because we want to.
Running out of time.
Yeah. You could talk about this for an hour, but we have to also talk.
Sure. It's incredible that a film like this is getting a theatrical release, like in commercial theaters, and it's going to have this amazing PR and publicity through like top entertainment marketing companies. So what does this mean for the Jewish world? That's my next slide. So they recognize that we have really the super marketing power when it comes to content. So they want to partner with the Jewish community. So for me, I see this as a really interesting film for the Jewish family service world, because you really service our elderly community and our survivors especially. And I believe this film really belongs to our survivor community. And I want them, if they're comfortable, to go to a theater to really see it when it comes out in theaters. So the organizations I've been speaking to, that's really been one of the main ideas, was how do we either help them get to the theaters, invite them? Do we have special screenings just for them? Do we host receptions with them as well? Are we doing post-film discussions? And I'll just say, kind of in the end, that's really the conversations in general with this film for all the cities that are having releases, which is to have lead partners come and host events around screenings at the theaters, especially that opening weekend. So we're doing that with federations, JCRCs, Jewish Film Festival, JCCs, and JF, Jewish Family Service Organizations. So I can talk specifically to each city that is having a theatrical release. And then the question is really the cities that are not getting this film in theaters, if there's interest to bring it to that town, that city, I'm talking to organizations that want to do that as well. And what does that mean? Because when the film's already going to be in a theater, there's no cost except buying tickets to the screening. But in cities that are not getting like a theatrical run for this one night, there is like a certain minimum commitment to actually, you know, so the theater makes some money, but ideally tickets are sold, theaters, everyone's promoting it. And there's such a large wave of PR and publicity from the distributor and everyone else is partnering around the country that you're selling out your tickets. Like, I don't want anyone to lose money on this. I want people to actually make money, use these events as fundraisers, et cetera. So I can talk more about that. I can talk more about the cities that the film's coming out in and cities that are potentially going to have these one nights. Happy to answer questions, happy to send private links to anyone who needs and like, and I will end with that. And thank you for having me speak.
Thanks, Tamar. There is a question in the chat. How do people find out which cities it's coming to?
So I'm happy to, first of all, I can paste it in the chat. Second of all, I can send it to Lisa to share with everybody. I'm happy to do that.
I think it'd be great to do both if you can, Tamar.
Sure.
So those of us who are on here can see it, and then Lisa can send it to the group so those who aren't can see it.
And there's also a request if you could send the slides.
Yes, definitely. Okay. I'll send that to Lisa also. Thank you. Right. Make it those cities.
Anybody else have any questions for Tamar real quick?
Okay. Hi. Private link.
Yes, I can get anyone who wants a private link.
How do we do that?
Nancy has a question.
You can definitely send Lisa an email and she can forward to me.
Thank you.
Might be the easiest way to do it. Those are the cities that are having theatrical releases. And I'll also share a list.
Want to say something, Nancy Masters?
Yeah, sorry. Hi. Thank you for presenting this. I just want to know, is this something that we can offer to our clients as a program, like as a film event, a private showing?
So right now, the main focus is on the theatrical releases. After the film is out of theaters, it, like most films, will be available for like licensing it privately. For cities that aren't getting theatrical releases, if they wanted to host a screening like the one night, that can be at a theater or it can be at a private venue. So I'm happy to talk about that. I ideally want as many screenings in either theaters or in like amazing, you know, our JCCs, some of them just have this, I mean, a lot of them have just those gorgeous theaters, like Omaha, Nebraska just renovated their theater. So I'd love people to see it during the release window because you get to kind of be part of that, but also definitely the film will be available after it's out of theaters. It'll be on iTunes also, you know, and be able to see online, but it's so important to see this on a, you know, a big screen if possible. But yes, in short, it will be available for licensing afterwards. I'm not sure that I'll be involved post the theatrical, but it goes to the normal system through the distributor's site.
So is it coming? Did you post the link of where it's coming?
Yes.
Is it coming to Montreal?
We don't see it.
So Canada is a good question. So
a private link. I got it.
Okay. So Canada's also getting the films in theaters and most likely in the major cities. I'm not focused on it so much. Montreal, Jewish Films, there's the library. They know about it. They're in touch with the distributor about it. But I think
it's
going to be
public library.
Yeah. JPL. Okay. They know about it. You can talk to them about it. I think it's going to be in theaters. I'm just not as focused on Canada with this film because the distributor actually licensed Canada to another distributor called Elevation. So they're, but I'm happy to, you sound like you know JPL. So you,
well,
you
we're in the same building.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Talk to, yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
And these are the one. Oh, that's why I'm sending it to Lisa. I'm so sorry.
I sent it to everyone. I copied and pasted and sent it to everyone.
Okay. The one night is, oh, wait, Lisa, you know, let me send it again. These are the,
Hold on.
And Tamar, maybe you could put your email. So if anyone wants, because we're going to have to switch to another topic, but maybe you could put your email in the chat and then people can have it and contact you directly.
Yeah, let me do that. That list I just sent, Lisa and I have also just sent it. That's getting run. So that's where there's like the week of screenings, 2 to 5 screenings at a commercial theater. And the second list is working on, did I send that twice? Sorry. The second list is the list of where I'm talking about doing these one nights. Most of the one nights are also between end of August and September time, like before Rosh Hashanah. And then some are also looking at post Rosh Hashanah times. So I mostly focus on the theatrical window, which is before Rosh Hashanah, knowing that end of August is also challenging for a lot of cities because of the end of the summer. But I'll send this all to Lisa. I know I have to go soon. I really appreciate you having me on here for so long. I know I've taken up too much time, but I'll send these lists to Lisa. Yeah, Yoni, go ahead.
I wanted to add a couple things because we had an opportunity to meet with Tamar. I viewed the film and some of our team members did. So sending the link, I think, is helpful for those who are interested. In part because, as I think most of you know, like we have a very large survivor community that's from the former Soviet Union, and in terms of it being viewable for our survivor group as opposed to the community, which I think is a different audience who might be very well interested in this. There aren't Russian captioning available. We talked about that possibility with Tamar. I don't think that that's something that's possible right now. And I also just wanted to say that, you know, I'm thinking that the other agencies might be wondering too, you know, how to make this happen. And, you know, one of the ways that we were thinking about is whether or not our federation or maybe our local Holocaust Museum or an organization might partner with us to sort of sponsor a certain number of tickets that, you know, we would not be charging, for example, our survivors to go see the film. And we may not have our own funding to be able to purchase the tickets to send our survivors, but it could be that federations could kind of sponsor that. And then also see that a certain percentage of the ticket sales might be a possible fundraiser if it's something that is workable to arrange, because I think that might be compelling for people who go to see the film, and also I think meaningful for those of us on this call who are doing direct service with survivors. I think the challenge, as I know Tamar, you and I talked about, is just the timing that it's coming up soon. So I think it's, you know, certainly the best way for communities to reach out directly to you and see, you know, what's being planned already and how you can kind of piggyback onto that. But just those are some of the kind of issues and ideas that we shared as well.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, I'm happy to speak to anyone kind of personally about either your city or interest in this. And I'm putting my email on here. Hold on a second. And then obviously Lisa and Yoni both have my contact information. I'm happy to get links out to everyone, get the PowerPoint out, get the cities out.
Terrific. Well, thank you for coming on and sharing this with us. And if anyone's interested, you know how to get a hold of her. So thank you, Tamar.
Thank you so much. I'll put my email on and go off. Thanks, everyone. Let me put my email on and then I will jump off so you can continue your meeting.
Okay.
And Lisa, how many people are on the meeting?
Right now, 35.
Okay. So it is a bigger group. We didn't have a set topic for the rest of the meeting. We wanted to kind of open it up to everybody to bring up topics. Yoni and I met, we came up with lots of things we'd like to discuss, but we don't want to dictate the meeting. We want all of you to kind of let us know what you want to talk about. But before we get started, we have 35. Do people prefer splitting up into small groups to have these discussions, or do you want to stay as a single group? And Lisa just put up a poll question. So if you can quickly answer it, we'll do whatever the majority wants to do.
It's so funny. I will tell you that this Holocaust Survivor Professionals affinity group likes to stay together. If I put this poll up on a lot of the affinity groups, they want to go into breakout rooms. And Yonit and Amy said, I don't think this group does. And they knew you. Okay, so that's it. I'm ending the poll. 30 out of 30. Four people wanted to break out and 26 didn't. That's enough.
None of us want to miss out on anything, right?
Like, right. It's the
FOMO, you did. I didn't share the results. FOMO? I'm so sorry. So 26 FOMO. Voted. They wanted to be all together, and four said they wanted breakout rooms.
Okay. 13% to 87%. So
okay. Well, that's a clear majority there. So we'll all do it together then.
Yeah.
So I know there's lots of topics on my mind. I have to say, at least every other day, something comes up, and I think, I wonder what other cities are doing about this. So, but we want to open it up to some of you. So who has a question or a topic they'd like to discuss?
Okay, Laura's got her hand.
Nobody comes up.
Laura has a hand up.
Oh, Laura has a topic. Great. Go.
I always have a topic. Are you kidding me?
Me too, Laura. Good to see you.
One of my questions is, with Panim right now. We in Boston still are not 100% in the office, and not a lot of our clients actually want people around. And we're not, just to explain, our community is quite large. And so it's not like we can run around and do Panim for everyone. And not everyone has families. I'm just curious how everybody is working with it and dealing with the stress of Panim. And the other part is also just the stress of if they haven't gotten the second part of the hardship fund, we're just getting a lot of phone calls. And the claims conference did write, call your local organization, they'll know. So when they call us, they just expect us to know what's going on. And it's, so it's just mixed messages, and we're having a little bit of difficulty with it. Just opening it up.
I wanted to say that you read our mind, first of all, because that was, Panim was one of the topics that we were thinking, and Amy and I certainly have been, working on dealing with in our agencies too. And I do think that, I believe Susan Levy is on with us too today. I'm not sure if we have other people from the claims conference who maybe can chime in on it, but we also are aware that last time when we met, or a couple times ago, we talked a little bit about some of the challenges we were having with Panim, and we at Holocaust Community Services have been working with Beth Sadek to kind of try to consolidate all of our concerns and the ones that you've shared with us, and also make some recommendations or some suggestions about how we think it might be better to work on with our survivors and for our agencies, because we are all experiencing that. So just that's sort of just as a framework. And again, I don't want to put Susan or anyone from Claims Conference on the spot here, but certainly we're always open to hearing what your suggestions are. And yes, we are having the same kind of issues that you're talking about, Laura.
I also just want to add one piece, if we do have someone from Claims Conference, it doesn't always work. So that's the other part, is that sometimes they do it and then it doesn't work. And so they get frustrated and they want us to come, like as if we're going to make it work. So it's just a little bit of lots of different pieces to the puzzle. And no, we don't have volunteers that will help, because right now we don't have a lot of volunteers.
Laura, we're having the same issues. I have to say our case managers usually, ask if there's any family around and say that we need you to do it. But many of them, say they don't want to bother their families or they're busy. Our case managers are running around and helping people do Panim. So most of them are working now, but we have one that this case manager has helped tried five times and cannot get it to work. So, and it's very aggravating. So, I don't know how many of those people are having where it's multiple times you can't get it to work. I don't know how anybody else is handling it. If other people are having case managers go to the field or not go to the field.
So Rami and Leah have answers to that. Rami, yeah.
Yeah, Rami. And
Amy,
Broward,
sorry.
It's okay. No, in Broward, all of our case managers have cell phones. So I push through the Panim app. So they have it on their cell phones. Cell phone for them. So when they're going to do home visits, we also have, you know, someone, and now with the whole idea with the Article 2, they're not getting live, you know, hard copies. So we're going to have all the Article 2 people that need help. I mean, I thought Greg's suggestion at the conference about having an event and bringing people together is really a good idea too. I thought that was an awesome idea and something that I was thinking about, you know, looking at the communities in South Florida also. So that's what we're doing.
So you'd be thinking, Rami, of doing kind of like a workshop sort of it, an opportunity for people to come and get help with it at your
site. I mean, I was thinking, like, for instance, like with Howard, with Boca, if we did something in Deerfield, then people from Boca could come, you know, and the people from Northern Broward could meet together and we could have all the care managers, some from Boca and ours up in that area working maybe on a Sunday at a place, and then have like a little type of Europa, like a small little gathering too, to see what we could do, to see those that help. I mean, our community, we are getting a handful of people now who are getting their second letter, you know, for the second payment. I did have one client who just actually called me. She already had gotten it okayed, and then they resent her a paper to do it again. So I have to go and work with her on Wednesday to help her figure out what to do with that. So,
yeah. Yonit, hi, this is Susan. I know you called me out. Sorry, I'm off screen.
Sorry to call you out. I just wanted to make sure everyone knows you're here too.
That's okay. So, but as you know, I'm really with allocations, and Panim has to do with compensation. So I don't have the answer for you other than to email the email address that I know is given to everybody and tell them what's been going on. I know you guys are doing that, but you know, we don't deal with that in my department. So I'm sorry, I can't provide any better information or guidance.
Yeah, except to just pass on the word that we're still all struggling with it.
Oh, we are. I can guarantee you. I sent an email today.
Leah's got something to say.
So we had something really interesting happen that I don't know if you all had this happen with Panim. We had a couple who the female got the Panim letter and got the money in her account for the hardship. And then the male kept calling and calling and calling. And finally they said, yes, a letter was sent. Well, he never got it. I mean, he called 2 weeks later, he called 3 weeks later, he called a month later. You know, he kept calling and calling, and the letter was obviously lost. So they told him to call me back each time, of course. So I kept talking to him. And finally, the claims conference informed me that I could go in to Panim without the letter, put down the registration number and his name and take his picture. And we have the app on our phones, and we have a special tablet that we've been taking out to the survivors. So we've really been trying to get everybody signed up, but I had no idea I was allowed to go out and do it if we had the registration number. Were you all told that at one time? Yeah. That you don't have to wait for the letter is what I'm saying.
So that's not true, because I specifically called, I was at a husband and wife's home where the husband got the letter and the wife did not. I had registration numbers for both of them. The husband we did, and then I was trying to put their, put the claim number and then her date of birth into Panim to take her picture since I was already there. It wouldn't go through. I called claims conference. I was specifically told by claims conference that unless they get the letter, Panim, and it wouldn't go through. So they said, no, you can't. You have to wait until she gets the letter.
How long ago was that?
So this was, I would say, about a month ago.
Oh, so this worked for me 3 weeks ago. So I'm not sure, but in claims conference specifically told me because the letter was sent and they didn't receive it to go ahead and do it. So,
oh, because the letter was sent. Okay, I see. Because the letter was already sent. But if the letter was not sent, even though you have a couple, or even if you know their number and you're already there, you can't do it.
I guess it has to be approved. But the
it
letter
looks like
was
Howard
not.
Has the answer.
I mean, it never got there. I have one more issue when we finish with Panini.
You mean, hold on, Howard.
Howard, you're muted.
I accidentally muted him. It was my fault. Go ahead, Howard. You have to unmute.
I can tell you my answer. The case managers in my office have gone out and helped people, sometimes successfully, sometimes not successfully. I told them 30 minutes maximum, and then you stop, and then we're going to order the paper life certificate that's available to order through the claims conference website on the front page. I'm a notary. I hate running around in the heat. Yesterday, I was up and down 4 flights of stairs in Century Village 3 times, but that's what needs to be done. That's what we'll do, and we have the time till October, so that's how we're doing it. But some days it works, and some days the case manager's done it multiple times, didn't work, and a family member did it multiple times, and she got yes, it went through, and she said, no, it didn't go through, and in the end, it didn't go through. She had to do it multiple times till it worked. Sometimes it's initial connectivity. Sometimes it's the app. It is really challenging for sure. But like I said, from my perspective, after 30 minutes, if it doesn't work, I'm done with it. Order the paper life certificate, will notarize it. And to my mind, the more that we bombard them with the paper one shows them that the app and Panim is not working. That's my perspective.
Howard, is that just for Article 2 you're ordering?
Yes. Right, because
hardship, we haven't been told that there's a paper alternative.
Right, that's not available because the hardship, at least in our area, I think the survivors already have done that and finished with it for the most part. The ones we're seeing right now are the Article 2 people. So we're, for them, after 30 minutes, they're saying, let's just order the paper life certificate and be done with it.
Sounds like all of you have a lot more staff. I mean, we just don't have the staff to do all of these different...
Oops, you're muted.
We have four people, but our area is relatively small. It's densely populated, relatively small area. So we run around like Meshuggahs, but we do it.
So,
but Laura, maybe the answer is to hold something at your office or something.
You have to deal
with transportation to help people get there, and not all the survivors can get there.
Right. And we don't have the budget to bring them all to us. And, you know, again, not all of us are in the office all the time. So we have an open time every week from, you know, 1 to 3 or whatever. But I'm just saying in general, people, and I'm not trying to take monopolize, but I'm just saying in general, we don't have enough staff to go around. We try to get people to do it. We're trying to get aides to help, neighbors to help, family to help. But if it doesn't work, they get very frustrated, both our staff and the client. And especially, I mean, they're all older, I'm not saying, but as I wrote in the notes, they're saying, oh, they just want us to die. I mean, so then I get, Howard, the 30 minutes that I try to say that too, but then the staff gets so, you know, they can't leave with an survivor feeling that way. So it becomes a catch-22.
But that's why I'd say to them, this didn't work. My alternative is I'll order you the paper one. As soon as it comes, call me and I'll be there to notarize it for you. So there is some closure there, minimal, but obviously I can't make happen what won't happen.
We also found out by trial and error that even when you do panim and it says it was received or approved on your phone, it doesn't always go through. And so we've had to have people then call, in addition to having the time spending, you know, with the client and not being sure. And it is very anxiety provoking because you're also very close. So forget about social distancing. And they, of course, can't be wearing a mask when they're taking the picture. So there's lots of issues that I know we've touched on and we're trying to convey. But even when it says, yeah, approved, you finally got it after however multiple tries you do it with your phone, then you're not sure that it's necessarily gone through. And we have found that it hasn't at times too. And then also Panim has had outages and like problems, and it's we've actually asked the claims conference if there's a way to sort of send an alert or notification, even like in the morning, so that care managers don't go out just for that. I also don't know if in other communities you're having this, where we're getting calls from survivors who are not our clients who need help with this. So they may not be needing our resources in other ways. And so we're also having to help them as well, in addition to our huge caseloads. And there isn't an alternative, Amy, for kind of the certification, because Article 2 always had life certificates. So survivors are used to doing these life certificates. They exist in paper, which is why you can request them, but it takes a while to get them. You know, I think when I did it with my Article 2 client last week, and it was definitely difficult, and I'm good with my phone and I'm good with that. And it was very hard. It said finally, after a few tries, like it was okay. And I basically said to her, I will figure it out. Like, I am going to call. If for some reason this didn't work, then we'll get you the paper one like we used to. And, you know, it was reassuring, but it is definitely a huge issue. And I know that, and Susan, I'm sorry for like putting claims conference on the spot, not you particularly, but claims conference in general. It's frustrating, even at the conference that we were at, you know, last month, when we hear that the rest of the world is doing fine with Panim and most people have received their payments. And the messaging is mostly about European countries who maybe have had more success with it for some reason. But when we meet together like we are now and hear how many people are still struggling and not getting their second payments, and in the midst of the process, clearly there's a disconnect between what is being sort of presented as this is to make it easy. This is all to make it easier. And it's working okay for most people versus what we're, it sounds like we're all experiencing.
I know that Leah had another issue to bring up. Leah, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Okay, so I've been working with a widow who needs to get the widow pension for the ghetto. And we've done the original paperwork, and I'm not seeming to get anywhere with a response. I know they've received it. I got it back. She got it back in German, and we were able to translate it. But I work with Beit Tzedek. I'm not sure. Are you all getting widow pensions answered and started after the survivor died?
Anybody have experience with that so far?
Howard, looks like.
I have done it in the past. I haven't done any recently, but it is a process, and the forms themselves can be very arduous. They send you this book to fill out, and hopefully the surviving spouse has the information that's necessary, because it's really essentially going back to the beginning and where the person was and what they did in recreating their whole life. So it is challenging. From my perspective, Beit Tzedek has always been very helpful in navigating the issues and just trying to make it as complete as possible. And then just being patient with the responses, but they usually have been successful. The most important to me is that you have that original insurance number that the survivor had. And sometimes the family members, the person dies and everything, whoop, out in the garbage, and then you have a real problem. But otherwise, if they have the information, it's just time consuming again, but I found that you do submit it and it works. Again, but it's time consuming. It's not going to be an immediate response.
I'd agree. So I work on a reparations in Chicago, and I'd agree. I've had maybe more issues with ZRBG, with the ghetto pension, lately. I do feel that before I was able to, you know, with widow pension, help the families fill it out, and within a few months, they would be approved. But I've had some cases that feel like they've gone on longer. And the issue is sometimes with BEG, the kind of older version of Article 2, the Wiedergutmachung, they have more offices, I'd say, so they have more contacts, and it's much easier to actually reach them either through mail, through help of German consulate, etc. I've asked our German consulate, I've asked New York's German consulate, I've asked Beth Zedek, I've asked even, actually, we partner with an attorney who used to almost solely do ZRBG work, and there's not really many contact people because it's like Social Security here. So the frustrating part is there's not even really a way to reach someone electronically. They don't accept anything but paper very often. So I wish I had a better solution, but I'm facing similar issues and haven't found really a great solution.
I mean, I can just say I think we're all experiencing the same things. If your question is on what forms and how to get it and what to do and how to fill it out, I mean, I'm always happy to go over what we know and what Beth Zedek has showed us in the past. I'm happy, feel free to reach out. In terms of length of time, what we're seeing, especially during the last 2 years, is a huge delay. Sometimes if there's one response back, there might be a case worker assigned. We've been somewhat successful in contacting ZRBG and those contacts. There's also a general number, but we don't usually get farther, but we just keep calling. So to try, so you can try some of those general numbers. And then what we're being told, or what I was told at some point, is that they're taking survivor stuff before second generation or widows. So what we're seeing, is it true or not? I have no idea, but we're seeing long length of time before those are approved over an initial application. So really similar to what everyone else's experience, unfortunately.
Heather, do you want to share what you also found and sent to our team about the application, the supplemental hardship fund application now? Because I'm not sure if everybody saw it since we just sort of discovered it on the website, right?
Sure. Yes, no, it is important to highlight. It was actually, I submitted something to the claims conference electronically and got an automatic reply. And it was, you know, they were saying we're inundated with calls and here are sort of the main questions and answers. And hopefully this will satisfy your question. So it was three sections. It was Article 2 and about the life certificate. It was, you know, the new widow's payments. And then for supplemental hardship fund, this goes for all of the funds, but they specifically put it under that section. As of the end of June, we can no longer, we as in everyone, agencies, survivors, their families, claims conference won't be accepting applications through email or through fax. So those were kind of COVID exceptions. And just like we now have to get, you know, hard copies of signatures from consent forms and NVE forms at our agency level, the survivors who are submitting applications, they now have to do so through regular postal mail. I mean, certified is fine, but they're not accepting electronic copies. So that was, you know, I thought that should be highlighted. And then just that they also put a note about supplemental hardship fund. Before, the timeline for approval wasn't very clear. We all learned by, you know, by doing them that payments weren't coming super quickly, but now they explicitly say it'll take 6 months or more for people who are submitting their supplemental hardship fund applications. So this, you know, if you email info@claimscon.org, they're still up until the end of June accepting electronic copies, but you'll get that same message kicked back. And if anyone wants to see it, I could also, it doesn't keep your client's information, so I could forward just the text of the message.
We can probably actually even copy and paste it into the chat here, but it's, you know, it's long, but you know, it's just hard because unless, you know, we had Heather happen to submit something and got that in response, but it wasn't something that was communicated to everyone directly. So.
Yeah, I'm glad, Heather, you shared that because I had no idea. So thank you.
Together we are better.
Yes.
Together we are frustrated.
Anybody have any other issues? Howard?
I have a question for everyone. I've had several people contact me who are still unfortunately receiving their BEG payments from Sarberg by check and telling me that they're delayed. Anyone else have that experience? Because I hate to tell people, let's tell them to cancel it, because then it's a 6-month wait at least to get a replacement check.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are on number 7 of the of people that have now called us, but it's not just from Sarberg. I did someone today and it's from Hanover. So I contacted the consulate. They had not heard of that anything yet. We're going to, so it's obviously something because it's not just one person. We're telling people we're going to wait till the end of the month. If it still hasn't, you know, they still haven't received it, the consulate has offered to follow up with their form. So that's the route I believe we're going to go through, you know, just seeing what happens in the next week or so. Yes, lots of other people. Not good, but comforting a little.
Hi, yeah. I wanted to ask something also. Are you finished, Howard?
I just wanted to say I'm trying to urge clients to use the direct deposit so we minimize these issues. I think some of them are definitely afraid of direct deposit. They're not that physical check, but to try to encourage as many of them as possible to use direct deposit to minimize the time we have to run around chasing lost checks. And we know the mail situation the last 2 years has been quite challenging.
Okay, I have a question sort of totally off topic of that. Last year we had started offering private pay for our clients, especially for clients that are Russian speaking or French speaking. Even in Quebec, sometimes we have a hard time finding workers that could speak the same language as our clients. So we started to do that where they would find their own workers and then they would fill out the timesheets and submit the timesheets and we would pay them. I just wanted to know, like, if you guys are doing, I think Yonit, I think your agency works like that, right? Like, how do you validate or, you know, the shifts or the service and make sure the quality is this of care is appropriate and things like that?
That could be its own 3-hour conversation. We actually did have a conversation this morning with a team from Winnipeg.
Yes, because they wanted to do it with us because they knew we were doing it because Winnipeg is attached to us.
I know.
Now I know. So they were asking to do it. And I was like, it's a whole can of worms, right? It's like
yeah. Well, as I started out the conversation with them, the grass is always greener on the other side, right? And there's always like issues with any kind of process. And I know, Nancy, we had some meetings together too to talk a little bit more about it,
right?
And how we manage it. And we kind of, and Susan will know because Susan was our program manager, program officer. I, you know, we inherited this model in Chicago where most of our home care is done through reimbursement and private pay. And we've made the best of it. And we, you know, just very quickly, I mean, we send timesheets every month, the client and the caregiver sign them. We send policies every 6 months. We have a client sign every single timesheet, client and caregiver, client and or POA.
And
it attests. So the policies are on the back of the timesheet in terms exactly. of understanding.
Yeah, we followed your model basically.
Right. So, you know, again, like we shared with Winnipeg, we're happy to share materials the way that we did it and adapted to it and the way, but as you noted, there are, you know, there's a downside to it in terms of being able to monitor what's really happening. But at the same time, I think that's true for all home care. We have probably more difficulties with our state-funded caregivers who are in agencies with, you know, vendors, home care vendors who are monitoring their work, and they don't show up, or they, you know, whereas the private pay hours that we're helping our survivors with, they have more control over. So if a caregiver is not doing those hours, they're not going to pay them for those hours. So it's a double-edged sword in many ways. And I'm happy if anybody wants to reach out and talk to us a little bit more about how we do it. But I know that, you know, your program officer, especially if you're using claims conference funds, will have to really work with you to make sure that is workable. You know,
for sure. Yeah. Are you doing a reimbursement? So the client is paying the worker first and then you reimburse the client?
Well, yes, although in a sense, once they start on this and there's a cycle of it, then it's necessary, you know, they catch up. The first time somebody gets home care, it's a challenge.
Because it could be quite expensive.
Well, it also takes a while, right? And it takes a while to process that reimbursement because we are checking to see that everything's filled out correctly and signed and all that. So the first time around, it's difficult. And so often they may have, you know, family members or limited savings, or we potentially could even use other funds or urgent funds to have that gap, that sort of bridge to this kind of model at the beginning. But once that cycle starts going, then they will get the check for their reimbursement once it's processed or direct deposit, and they can then pay their caregiver. But yeah, it's another issue, especially at first.
Right.
Nancy?
Yeah.
I was just going to jump in. I'm not going to go on too much because we do a reimbursement kind of like Chicago does. So we have them sign. We have a reimbursement form. They have to fill out the hours, the aid in the person signs. We will only pay now the reimburse the client. There came up a question years ago whether we would pay the caregiver directly. And I talked to an attorney who kind of advised us that we shouldn't be doing that.
No, it's a whole tax issue then.
Yeah. And then, you know, are they considered your employee? And there's all kinds of questions. And we do have all them clients sign a waiver of liability and a release, basically saying that they understand they're in charge of hiring, firing, they're in charge of training the person. That
So yeah, we have that in our contract.
And the other thing I would say, and you know, Yonit highlighted it. I mean, yes, it's hard for oversight, but there could be issues with agency aides too. And oftentimes these aides that people hire privately are more consistent and they can have the same aide more hours. But we do make an effort. Every case manager, if they're using a private aide, has to meet the private aide. Just so we have eyes on the person, we know we meet them, who it is. And we also don't let family members be the aides.
No, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
We've had a few that ask and we just say no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good idea. I like that, yeah.
And people have responded in the chat too, Nancy.
Yeah, I see a lot.
And what about like doing spot visits? Like, do you do spot visits? Because you never really know when they're going to come necessarily, right? You don't have to schedule.
We haven't done spot visits. We could if you know the hours the person is working, but we haven't done it that way.
We can't really because of the volume, but we do ask when we do assessments, our, you know, regular assessments, we ask when the caregiver is coming. We have like a chart that we use, and we try then to have our social workers or care managers either visit them when the caregiver is supposed to be there or call when the caregiver is there, so that there's a little bit of that at least messaging about accountability.
Yeah.
Howard, you had your hand.
Thank you so much for all of your inputs.
I am not an attorney, so I'm not giving legal advice here, but one thing I was told is that people need to be wary of if they are hiring the aide, depending on the number of hours, they may be considered legally the employer and then have to deal with all the issues of employment, of unemployment insurance, disability insurance, all those things. And if they don't, then the caregiver can turn around to them for all that. So they should be very careful about doing that, make sure they're living up to other obligations as an employer if it applies to them, depending on the number of hours they're hiring the person.
Yeah, or the worker themselves could be like an independent business, right? Right.
But yeah. Essentially, we do avoid dealing with that. That's certainly true, but we're paying the client and we're not, they're paying the caregiver. So they're not our, you know, they're not, it's not directly coming from our agency. So, but those
are exactly.
But I'm saying, but the client may be considered the employer then, and they have to then pay exactly. those taxes. So they have to be careful that they do what's appropriate and not wind up being sued later on by an aide. Because I've heard that there are attorneys exactly. out there that are looking yeah. for this kind of business.
Right.
Yeah,
that's why we have them sign a waiver.
Gail had a question also.
You may have just answered in the chat. I wanted to know how much you reimburse for that hourly rate for the private caregivers.
Well, in Montreal, it's quite, well, it's $19 an hour, but because we don't pay any fringe benefits or anything like that. So it's quite low. I think Montreal is quite low in general. The market is lower than elsewhere. But,
is that the same rate that agencies charge you?
No. The agencies, like a third party agency, is charging, you know, the worker plus their administrative, you know,
yeah.
part. Yeah, it's like $28, $29 an hour. Very and different.
Here is where I can chime in. It's Susan. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Susan. How are you?
I've been here in a long time. Good. So I get to see, you know, the reports from agencies worldwide and universally, and it's really what is expected. Private pay should be much less than a vendor for yeah. just the reasons you said, Nancy, but it could range, you know, because from, you know, very low to, you know, a little bit higher, it's really whatever the survivor or their family decides with the employee. So it is definitely expected not to be the same amount as a vendor. That's one of the benefits. You can hire, you know, at a lower rate than vendors.
Exactly. Yeah. But then like, you know, like the tax issues come up because, you know, some of them are earning more than $40,000-$50,000 a year at the end of the day. If you have a heavy care client, you know, it's getting 80 hours a week. I mean, that seriously adds up. And, you know, we also say we're not responsible for the tax implications, but this home care worker should be filing it on their tax return. And then they may want more money. I don't know. Like some people don't realize it. And then they pay the tax after the fact. You know, this is like we're just a year over now and it's ramping up. So I don't know what kind of impact it's going to have. We haven't heard anything so far, but it's only been one tax.
We've been doing this for probably 10 years. We've never had a client come to us with any employment issues or tax.
Okay, great.
I mean, I don't know what they're doing about it, but
yeah.
and also we're just so you know, we're reimbursing at $17 an hour.
Okay, interesting.
And we do now have some clients that are paying more than that, but we're capping it at eight.
Exactly, like we capped
it. They're having to pay the additional.
Well, I think it all depends on what our allocations and our funding, you know, is too, in terms of what we can and can't pay, obviously, and whether or not we're doing reimbursement or home care agencies, because that is so different. So in Chicago, for example, we try to at least meet minimum wage, but so minimum wage right now is $15 per hour. So it's sort of similar, I think, in US to Canadian dollars at the $19 rate. I think we did it while we were talking to Winnipeg and it was like $14.71 was your rate in US dollars. So we try at least to be considerate of that, but we know yeah. that it's such a low pay for our caregivers who are doing such hard work. So we're
exactly.
always trying to advocate for both for more funding and also right. for an increased rate so that it's harder and harder, as we all know, to get home caregivers, to retain them. So those are all a multitude of issues that come along with this.
Exactly. Yeah, we were paying $17 an hour and then we bumped them all up $2 during COVID and it's going to stick. I mean, the cost of living is such that you can't take that away now. It's not a temporary bump up anymore.
But you have to be able to sustain it. You know, we have to be able
I know.
Well, that was, I was going to ask
part.
About.
Well, we saved the fringe benefits. So there you go, right? You saved the employer levies. So.
Go ahead, Gail.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about overtime. I know during COVID, during the pandemic, a lot of the agencies had very few caregivers. Many of our clients were using the same caregivers in overtime. It's impossible to sustain that. We put in a request to the claims conference to increase our hourly average rate that we're allowed, but the overtime hours are killing us. Is anybody else having that issue? And what are you doing about it? short of reducing the hours or changing the agency?
Well, I'll just say we do not cover overtime pay. We have in our vendor agreements with the various home care agencies, we say we do not cover overtime. We will pay time and a half for holidays. But other than that, we say we stick with the hourly rate.
Yeah, that's true.
Anybody else pay overtime?
We only did it exceptionally during COVID, but it was maybe 6 or 10 hours max a week for a few different clients, but that was it. So very nominal.
Yeah. We'll pay holiday pay, but we don't pay overtime.
There are times when we haven't been able to avoid it if somebody needs a 12-hour shift, but we try to reduce it and to work with the agencies to only do 8-hour shifts.
Anybody else have any issues they want to bring up? I know I have a list, but I wanted to let everybody else.
The questions and comments are really interesting too in the chat. Adam was asking how much more agency staff support do you need for tracking all the paperwork? A lot. I suppose it depends. You probably have a lot of work to do when you have your own home care agency that you're managing as well, different kind of labor connected to that in terms of your administrative work. But yeah, we do have it. We have positions in our finance department who process all of the timesheets and do the direct deposit and checks. They're not directly part of our team, but we are supporting those positions with our budget. So it does take a lot. And of course it depends on how many clients you have and all of that as well. And there's a big range.
I don't know, for us, it's actually easier to do the private pay paperwork from on our end. I don't know the accounting end of it because we're getting one sheet where they put the hours and the client is signing as opposed to our home care vendors, which are sending mounds and mounds of telephony records. And we have to go through and make sure all the hours match up to what's on the invoice. So the private pay ones are much easier.
For us, private pay is easier too because the timesheet calendars we send out match up with our Monday through Sunday week. And a lot of times with vendors, we're getting either a month at a time or their week is different from our week or they mm-hmm. spend 2 weeks. So we have to do a very complicated calendar system to make sure that we don't do weekly hours that are incorrect.
I think it's kind of amazing how many different processes and systems we all have. And so like kol hakavod, Susan, and you have to sort of grapple with so many different approaches to home care and flexibilities in terms of how we each do it. But I think ultimately for us, at least the experience of private pay is that it does seem to empower our clients more to be able to hire the people who they feel comfortable with and to be able to control that work experience too. Whereas with our state benefits, as I said, it's really a problem when people, caregivers don't show up and clients don't wanna have us advocate for them because they're worried about getting in trouble or rocking the boat. They don't, and so it's really kind of a mess in terms of the state system as well. Laura.
I just have a question because one of the things we have found is that we have a few people who are doing private pay, but they're not really all there. And so, they live alone or something and they have a full-time aide and we're paying for a certain amount of hours or whatever it is. And so the problem is they're not able to sign. And so I'm just curious, like sometimes I do find it easier to have private pay, but not when it's someone who forgets to send us the the timesheet or whatever. In some ways for us, the agencies are a little bit smoother because they're actually on top of whoever is signing and calling the families. They're actually more fearful of us because of the auditing, because we get them, with the auditing stuff. So it's interesting just to hear that you all find it easier to have the private pay.
I was going to say, I'm just going to chime in here, that there are some agencies that actually do like three different models. They have their own internal workers, like Cummings, who's, you know, most of their workers are internal in Montreal, but some agencies have internal workers, use outside vendors and private pay. I think for auditing purposes, private pay is the most challenging because you have to get those, you have to get all of those timesheets from a lot of clients. I mean, Chicago has a huge number of clients. If you have a small agency, then it probably doesn't make such a difference. But if you have a large agency, just in terms of workload, I would guess vendors or internal clients are easier in terms of work. But we want the agencies to do what they feel is best for the clients and their agency.
Yeah, we use all three methods actually. So it's busy, but yeah, private pay is very time consuming and administrative because you like have to get them and make sure they got in. You've got to make sure you pay them as soon as possible because they're out of pocket, making sure that they're filling it out right. But I mean, once they get on a roll, it's not too bad. But we can find the workers that they need. They can find their own workers. So it's perfect. It works, yeah.
Laura, if we have clients who are not with it to sign, it's usually the POA that's signing the sheet.
We do too, but then if they're like not necessarily there or they're not, you know, we want them to, how do they know that the person's there? So I don't want them having it at their house if they don't live with the, you know, client. So it's sort of a mixture because that was one thing when we got audited last year that, you know, the auditor wanted to know, how do we know if the person's really there if a POA is signing it and they don't live with the person? So it was a little bit of, we had to do a little bit of finesse to make sure that we know and follow up with that.
Well, do you have any home care agencies that are relying on the clients to sign as backup? Like they're not using telephony? Because then you can-
Every single agency of ours in Boston does not, we do not do, oh, am I muted? No, we don't do any of that. Every single agency that we work with has timesheets that the aide and the client sign all the way through. And we have like a lot of different agencies, but that was one of the things with the auditor that he told us that we had to do. The other thing is that it was interesting because the auditor was like, we're using so many different agencies that it was almost like a little crazy. So I'm trying to make it so that we're not doing as many and not, you know, but we have, I mean, in Boston, we have over 120 clients with home care and some have to use two different agencies just to make sure that they have the aid. So it's even just keeping track of all of that.
But you, Laura, you're saying, sorry, the auditors are looking that the time she's signed by both the worker and the client.
Oh, yeah.
If I can ask a question, is anybody using the doctor form if a client's not able to sign as opposed to having a POA?
You mean the MAS?
No, there's a doctor's form when a client is unable to sign that you have to get the physician to do. Because that's a big question. We're going to be audited soon and they were asking the question this morning.
Anna, did you have the answer to that? Anna Klein, did you raise your hand?
I can chime in. This is Susan. This has to do with, if you go on the claims conference website, it has to do with compensation that you get a doctor's form if they're unable to sign. And we are actually currently working on a policy how to move that over to exactly what you guys are talking about. But Heather just wrote that. It's detailed for compensation, but it would apply also if you could get that doctor's note, that would be great for timesheets as well. And we are coming up with other policies to help agencies with this issue because it comes up actually pretty frequently. Even vendors do, if there's no telephonic system, which some agencies have and some don't, but even vendors do ask clients to sign. So it doesn't, you know, change that requirement, whether it's a vendor or private pay.
I just wanted to note that is it really time?
Oh my goodness.
Could that be? Lisa? It is. So some of us, if we want, can stand for a few more minutes to talk. But I also, I think we wanted to get a sense of whether or not this sort of open forum is something that we want to continue to do next time. We've had mixed kind of, opinions about whether to have topics, speakers, or kind of open forum. I'm seeing some nods when I said that, but.
Here, turn off your cameras. Everyone turn off their cameras.
What?
Stop their video. Turn off your camera and then we'll turn it on if we want to continue to have an open thing because I didn't do a poll.
Oh, wait a minute. So wait.
Everyone
so
turn off your camera, right?
Okay.
And
okay.
Turn off your camera, top right. Everyone turn it off. Okay, so the question is, do you want to continue to have open-ended conversations like this? Over.
So we start the video if we want to.
Turn on the video if that's what you want.
You're so cool, Lisa.
Way to do it. So, look at this. I think more people want to have open-ended conversations than don't.
Okay, that's great. We could also do a little bit of both, but I think we should stick with the open-ended for now.
We can. We can certainly do a little bit of both. And we can it happened to be that the Panim subject was one that we were thinking of too. We were also thinking about going back to in-person services, that was something that's on our minds and how are we doing that with all kinds of issues around still about COVID. It's not gone yet. So, there are definitely things that we can suggest. And then maybe we can then have a little bit of both, as you said, Amy, sort of.
Yeah, we didn't get to my topics on my list other than Panim. That was on my list too.
Do you want to tell everybody what your topics
are? Well, I did have the social programming. Well, what's everyone doing now in terms of in-person? I also wanted to know what agencies were doing in terms of training case managers initially when they come on. And also, is there any kind of continuing education with the case managers? And that doesn't mean they're licensed. I mean, I know licensed people have to have continuing education, but many of us don't have licensed social workers that are case managers. So that was one. I wanted to talk about administrative overhead a little bit. That's probably not such a popular topic, but I'm sure I could think of a couple other topics too.
Well, so I just want to say, sorry, Yonina, I just wanted to make sure everyone saw in the chat, we changed the date. Right? It's no longer going to be September 8th. It's going to be August 25th. So you'll get an email around that, but I'm telling all of you because you're on this call.
And Lisa always reminds us that we can also have pop-ups and we can have sort of mini groups too. If there's a particular topic, instead of our talking like agency to agency, which is great and we love to do it, maybe we have a few agencies kind of coming together on something too. So you know where to find us. Please let us know. We love this conversation. And so we want to hear what's on your minds and what's helpful. All right.
So enjoy July.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
So good to see everyone.
Nice to see everyone.
Yeah, have a nice day. Are you there? Stay on for
see
one
you at
second.
The next one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yonita, I was going to stay on.
Yeah, I want to talk to you for 2 minutes. What?
I just also, if I can just say quickly, there is a thing on Diamond. There's a checkbox for people who can't sign. And that I'm going to try, and because we're being audited in December. So I want to make sure that we have that lined up with clients we know that can't sign.
Oh, really? Where the checkbox is in the personal section under each client?
Give me a second. I'll take a quick look at it.
I have never noticed that.
There's lots of stuff in there.
Why are you holding that till the end for these two people?
I tried to, but there was other people. Everyone was talking.
Susan, I have to go
in a minute. You guys can stay on. I just wanted to say hold on for 1 second, Howard. I've got a great idea. Remind me for next time for us to get to know each other in a different way. It's going to be so much fun. Okay.
Awesome.
My last group.
Lisa, can you also send us the chat? Would that be possible?
I can send you the chat.
Because there's so many good questions and comments, and there were some
on Monday, Monday, I'm going to send, because I'm leaving at 5 o'clock to go to a wedding in the Hamptons. Hello. So I'm all dressed and ready to go in the car. So I can't do it now, but I'm sending on Monday. the chat, Tamar's stuff, the change of date. Anything else you want me to put in there? Whatever someone else wrote in there, something. Amy, maybe you wrote it in
there. I'm sorry, I was just scrolling through the chat.
That's what I'm writing. If you can think of anything else, let me know, you guys, okay?
Okay.
Bye, thank
you. Do you have
bye
to switch? Guys. Oh, Yonit, are you a host?
She's the host. I made you the host.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
When you're in Diamond and you click on the personal details, there are all kinds of check boxes in there. And one of them on the right-hand side is unable to sign.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. I never knew that. Wow.
That's really interesting.
So I'm going to try to make sure those are lined up with those that don't sign. So, hey, I documented. What else do you want me to do?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and can you tell me too, I know that everybody else is off, but I mean, technically we like to have POAs sign these reimbursement forms, but I could have sworn that in a previous call with the claims departments, they never came out with a formal policy. So they were basically letting agencies do what they want. So if the client doesn't have a POA, but they have a spouse or a daughter or someone who can sign, that you could just let them sign it. So it doesn't have to be a POA.
I don't know. My suggestion would be that everyone speak with their specific program officer and get that feedback and that sign off. And then I would print out that email and hold it like gold.
But yeah, do you have any people signing these? Either of you, do you have people signing these forms that don't have a legal POA?
Occasionally we do. And we, like Howard said, we make sure that it's written in the assessment why that is. The problem is that you can't easily get POA once somebody has severe advanced dementia, right? And to do some sort of what's the program, the next level,
the guardianship?
Guardianship is a nightmare.
Oh, no, that's a nightmare.
Yeah, so we just try to document it. But I think that it's also like the suggestion of letting your program officer kind of know is not a bad idea either. Because I remember too, even in our audits, like if there was some weirdness about anything, whether it was like a signature was really late because of whatever, or some sort of anomaly, if we noted it, it was okay. Like at the time, they were like, just explain it to us. Right. Like, just make a note on here as to why this is this way and initial it and date it. And then we'll know that you were aware of what the complication was. So I think it's true in that sense too. I mean, we're not going to force guardianship at this point. And somebody who can't sign is either Parkinson's and can't sign or, you know, dementia. Right. I mean, what are you going
to
do?
Well, I have to say, we've been audited twice. We're probably overdue, but for an audit. But they never once were looking, as far as I know, because they never said anything about who was signing. So if the client wasn't signing and it was the daughter or the, never said a word to us about who was signing. Right.
If it's someone in the household, what they're essentially looking for is proof that the service was rendered, whether it be home care, meals, whatever. So we had a whole issue that came to the meals that during COVID, or even before, prior to COVID, it was hard for the volunteers to get signatures and became a whole to-do. Prove that the volunteer didn't take the meals home. That's what the auditor told us. Like, really? The volunteer who's living in these country clubs is going to take the frozen meal from someone? Yeah.
Well, and the majority of our clients are widows. So a lot of them are living at home. So if you get someone, I mean, but it's the same thing with an agency, whoever has to sign it, unless it's
And maybe you call it then like a proxy or something, and it's now power of attorney, but you somehow like indicate that you're aware that this person signed as proxy to this client because they're unable to for A, B, or C reason. And I think as long as the gist of it is that you're aware that this is an issue, but that you're confirming that the services were actually received.
Document, and that's what they wanted. That you're aware, right?
By the way, I have a question for you guys. This could have been a topic today too, but so, you know, we had during COVID, the flexibility, they were pausing the 18-month reassessment and now it's ending.
Right.
So do you know, is there an expectation that now you'll, by June 30th, you will have done everybody's within 18 months, like all the ones that were past due?
I don't know what the expectations are, but I've been urging my case managers to get as many done as possible, because when it comes to when we get that email, anyone that's overdue comes in red. And my CEO sees that, and she sees red, and she gets really annoyed. So we're trying to get as many done as possible.
Right. And that email is at 15 months or something like that. It's not even at 18 months. Right. So you then have time to address it.
Right. But,
well, they have the ones in red that are past due, and right, then they have the 15 months. Right. I mean, our regional program did get an email from our program officer saying, you know, I see you have a lot that haven't been done in 18 months. What's your plan? Or basically, right, but I don't know, like, are they going to get, I mean, presumably you guys have much bigger populations. You've got to have a lot that probably weren't done with 18 within.
No, we've pretty much done all of them.
You have. Okay.
We had well over 100.
Yeah.
Well over 100 that were overdue.
Oh my goodness. Overdue.
So we don't have very many that are over the 18 months. We have definitely, our best practice is to do it every year. And I'm saying that it was remote too. I'm not saying that we did it in person, but we did do the assessment and the reassessment. So we do have some that are kind of at that middle place, like 15 months, 14 months or whatever, but we have very few out of our 1200 home care, 1800 that are more than 18 months. We just continued to do what we could. I mean, we just, you know, so I would say that if it's been 18 months since the client had an assessment, that now that the COVID flexibilities are over, that it is probably important to do them ASAP.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. They're saying they're not going to give you any flexibility on that at this point.
Right.
How many would you say are overdue, Amy?
It's the regional program. There's
the regional program.
10 or something like that. It's not that many, but I didn't know, you know, are they going to get really tough about it if they're not done by June 30th? I mean, the flexibility is ending June 30th. So technically, I would think they should give you a grace period to get them done. But in the Georgia program, we're all up to date, but it's the region program.
In one of the previous emails with the listings, my program officer did reach out to me and say, well, these are overdue. What's your plan? I said, we're starting to work on them to whittle it down. So she was okay with that. We're working on it. But one of the things I asked her about is, even come July 1st, can it be done remotely still? And she said, yes, preferable in person, but remotely by phone is still okay.
Like we're continuing to, we will have to get signatures on like NVE if they don't have an NVE. I mean, most of them, if there are clients already, they have an NVE, you don't have to get it again. Same with consent, but declaration of income and assets and our own like permission to release, we're going to get hard, real signatures. That's the difference starting July 1st. But it doesn't mean that everybody's going to be seen in person if it's not safe to do it, or if they can't, we will just mail them those forms and they have to return them to us and we'll track it.
So, but do you ever have, don't you have, so after July 1st, this is what I wasn't sure about. Like, so we sometimes will send the documents via email and the clients will send them back by email. So then you don't have the original signature. I mean, you have the email copy. So
if it is it a real signature that they're scanning?
Yeah, they signed it at home.
I think as long as the signature, I think it's not about it being.
It's not about a copy versus
That's unsigned. Until now, you can do it unsigned. But we've always, throughout the whole time, been sending by regular mail to people, and I put in our return envelope, postage paid, and they mail it back to us.
We don't always get it back, but we've been putting with verbal consent or whatever, you know, for up until now. But now, if they send it to us electronically, if someone signs it and somebody scans it for them, you still have the signature.
I just didn't know if you needed the, all right, that's
right. No, I don't think you need, I think they're over that. I mean, I think they used to need paper for everything, but I think there've been enough agencies that have moved to electronic files so that Detroit did, and I know Circle of Care in Toronto did, that they're understanding you still need a signature and it can be maintained digitally. But I think they're over the fact that you have to have every single thing in a paper file.
Yeah.
I finally got Adobe Acrobat. I battled for them for a long time because we do all the drafts remotely. I used to get them from the case manager. I had to send it to my personal computer. I had a personal computer, I had something to sign electronically, then send it to my work computer, and then print it out. I finally got Adobe Acrobat so I can sign off electronically. They cleared it all. So I have all electronic signatures. No more handwritten signatures on them.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Adobe, I don't know if you're talking about Adobe Acrobat, but it's also a mess though. Like we, when you sign it electronically, it locks it. And so, you know, we have like a care manager, our social workers do the forms first, and then supervisors, we work with them, and then we need to sign it. Certainly DAF, but also even just our other assessment process. And if they sign it and then it's locked, then we can't sign. It's like, it's a mess, and it freezes, and you know, it's not the easiest system.
And this was, we were talking about DocuSign, but DocuSign requires emails from clients, which they don't have. Thank you very much. So I say, you know what, let's deal with the DAFs. The most important issue is the DAFs that I can sign electronically. We got that done. But unfortunately, I didn't say this, but my agency was too cheap to buy a program like Philadelphia has, and I think Toronto has, that organizes all of it and has beautiful flow, but it's money. Oh,
believe me, I know. We don't have one either that has beautiful flow, but we're actually working with Circle of Care right now with their developers of their Easy Care system, it's called. I don't know if you remember, they presented about it in Atlanta.
Right, exactly.
Everybody was like, wow, we call it Wow Care, but to try to convince the agency to do it, and we'll even pay for it. We have the funds to pay, like, we can pay for it, but even with paying for it, our agency is like, we need to make sure it's right for blah, 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 blah. And so we are really struggling. We're finally going to do, I think, a demo environment to at least sort of prove that this would make things so much easier than what we're doing now.
Yep.
They have an amazing...
Our problem came down to money. And the problem is, once you're making it work without it, then why do you need it? So at least thanks, I got the OW Acrobat, that resolved that, at least that main issue for right now.
Right, like prove that it's what you need, not just what you want. And it's just like, well, we needed to do our work efficiently and
appropriately.
And appropriately and within compliance and, you know, with accountability. That Circle of Care program tracks everything you're doing behind the scenes. So like if you're on they have a Zoom platform within it. They have, if you're on Zoom, if you're on a call, it'll track the amount of time that the worker, whoever it is doing that. They have the DAF embedded in it now because they work with Claims Conference to accept that. So you can fill that out. Everything is populated. Like when we have to do our forms, even in Adobe and even in Acrobat, or whatever, you have to re-enter all the demographic data in their system. You do it once, it'll populate all those forms with all of that information. You don't have to continue to enter it over and over. So wish us luck with our advocacy. My supervisor said my middle name should be Advocate the other day. I don't have a middle name, so I could.
Considering that the budget that we get from Claims Conference represents more than 50% of our agency's annual budget, they should invest in it, but there's just so much I can push it.
Not that, you know, like getting Adobe or something, Adobe Pro, Professional, whatever, it's not that crazy expense. It's not like, you know, $50,000. It's so it's short.
But is Howard, as my CEO said to me recently, we're 20% of our agency budget, but she said they lose money on us basically because we don't get enough in administrative overhead from the Claims Conference. So you know, they're not likely to pay out a lot of money on something when they're already having to cover a lot of things that the Claims Conference isn't covering.
That's true. And that was at that conference, I think, Amy, in Atlanta, that someone asked the Claims Conference, what's your typical administrative percentage that you, or something like that? And I think they said something like 8% or something. I don't remember what it was, but it was like way higher than any of us get in our admin line. And so we've been using whatever they said in our narratives, in our, all of our advocacy, like it was, as was said at the, you know,
I think ours is like 6.4% or something like that.
Ours is even less, much less. And
I forgot.
We're around 6% because we got just about 10 million. We're 640,000 for admin.
I think our admin, I'm not sure. I don't want to quote it because I'm not sure, but it's not good. It's not even the typical grant administrator will put 10% in, you know, for administrative.
That's what it used to be. It used to be percentages, and they eliminated that, but we did get a bump a couple of years ago in admin to the current level.
Yeah.
So we have
but not in the case management, but not in case management.
Correct. That sounds right.
No. Oh my right. God. We haven't had a bump in 5 years in case management.
That is ridiculous. Right. I mean, yeah. We've gone from 250 clients to 1,800 clients to 2,000, and case management has stayed like the same.
You haven't had that either. Have you gotten a bump in administrative overhead?
We did. So now that I'm thinking of it, we got like up to, I think, around 600 or something. And we also get about 10 million or something. But think about how many clients do you have, Howard? How many?
We have just about 400.
So think about the fact that we have 1,800 and we have the same allocation as you.
That's crazy. That is insane.
I mean, it is insane. It makes me crazy. It's like, I don't know who I was talking to at the conference who said they had like 700 clients and they get $24 million.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That was the lady in Florida.
Yes, it was.
Miami.
Patty.
Miami. Or Broward.
But I'm sorry, like they're getting like more than twice as much as
we're getting. Yeah, I know. It is crazy.
Clients. You know why? Because they are paying agency rates too. Like they're paying higher healthcare rates. We're paying $15 an hour. We could never move out of that model.
Right. We're paying $21 right now. It just went up as of April. And I had to submit to our program office in the Senate of Germany a request to bump up to $25 an hour. Because that even $25 is considered low. I did a survey, had a attached to my email to the program officer. Yeah. 25 is a starting point. 30 and more is where lots of agencies are going to in Boca area.
Did you get it approved yet?
I just went last month.
Yeah.
So it's going to be probably a half a year, probably for next year.
They asked us too. And we said, look, if you want to do incremental increases and go back to the German government every time it's over like 10%, which is not very much when you're talking about $15, an hour, then that's your problem. But they said, look ahead, what would you in a few years think the rate should be? So we also said at least 25. Agencies are charging between 25 and 35.
Yep.
We want to even write, not that we would have the money to be able to pay everybody $25 an hour now. We could never do that. But for those who need higher level of care or need specialized agency care, at least we could, do that. So, anyway,
my fear is that we're going to get an increased rate, but not an increase of the spending cap. And then we're really screwed.
Exactly. That's actually what we said to our program officer is, we can tell you what we think the rate should be, and we can request that, but we can't promise that we'll use that because we won't have enough money unless you give us a lot more money, unless our allocation is bigger. And she said it would not be punitively, like if they raise the cap and we can't meet that, then they'll understand if they're not giving us more money.
Part of my problem is what's driving a lot of it is we have our own home care agency. So to keep them in the black.
Yeah. Oh, that's a conflict of interest, kind of. It's like.
But it is a real issue, but it has conflict of interest overtones.
Are you required to refer clients to to your own agency?
We have to give them first right of refusal.
That's a problem.
But oftentimes they can't staff it. They have no Russian speakers, so we have so many Russian new clients primarily, so they don't staff that. They don't do cleaning, so that's a lot of stuff. So they're pretty niche. So that's part of the problem also. But I try to stay out of that because that's not my problem. I got my own budget to worry about and not that agency.
Hmm. Oh boy.
Well, I could keep talking for hours,
All right. I needed to say something to Susan. Just like I needed to let everyone know, like Susan's on. Susan Lee.
I'm glad you did. Yes.
Like, here, just so you know, it doesn't mean we can't be honest and transparent, but just so you know, I was quickly looking through the participants, like who's here?
No, that was a good call.
I always look through all just to see if I know who I know. So,
by the way, before I leave, I like your picture, Yonit. I recognize it.
Do you, Howard?
Chicago River.
Yes, very good.
Yeah.
Today I was on this call with Winnipeg this morning, as I said, and they're like, where is that? Where are you? And I'm like, it's Chicago. I'm not at the river right now, but I was a couple weeks ago. Like, we don't associate Chicago with that view. I'm like, really? Well, you don't? Like, this is Chicago. This is
downtown. I know. I love that picture. That's
it's such a great city. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a great city.
It really is.
I love it so much in the winter, but it's
yeah. Well, it's 99. It was 99 here yesterday, so I felt I needed to have something like refreshing in the
background. All right, I'm gonna get going, guys. All right.
Good seeing you.
Bye bye.
Thanks so much. Bye. Take care. Bye.